You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Each episode, we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of the history of our region and beyond. Today, I am taking you back into the field, and we are deep in the archives of Southern Oregon Historical Society. This is the second largest collections in the state of artifacts and objects and ephemera that tell the history of our region. So today I am tagging along with a historian and curator here to learn about some of the early landscape art and a little bit more about Peter Britt. So Peter Bogue, why don't you introduce us yourself really quick and tell us what you are interested in here.
I'm a professor at Washington State University and a historian of the Pacific Northwest, and I'm working on a project on early Oregon and Washington landscape paintings.
And we're here with Anna Sloan, curator of the Historical Society, who has generously invited me along to kind of look over the shoulder and see what they're finding. So Anna, what have you got going on here?
So we're out here at our storage facility where we keep all of our three-dimensional artifacts and objects, including all of our framed artworks. So today we've pulled some of the oil paintings that Peter is interested in looking at as part of his research. We've got a lot of landscapes to take a look at today. So in front of me is a rolling wall where we store some of our artworks, and we're about to pull some down so that Peter can take a look at the back of the paintings and see if there's any additional information.
And I'm excited here because I'm seeing originals of stuff I've only seen photographs or digital images of. So right in front of us, we've got two paintings of Peter Britt's home village in Switzerland. We've got a portrait of his beloved wife, Amalia. And then, of course, what Peter's here for, two landscapes of Crater Lake. One of them, you said you recognize this image. There's a couple of deer in the front.
So there's a photograph in the collections dated from 1875 by Peter Britt himself, where he took a photograph of this. So this painting dates at least from 1875, and it may have come after his initial trips when he photographed Crater Lake for the first time and worked from photographs in his studio painting. But he was a portrait artist, so it's really interesting to see his work on landscape. And I have to say, seeing them in person is much better than seeing the photographic images.
And this image, or you know, the original photograph of this image, is credited as being the first photograph of Crater Lake, and reportedly was instrumental in it becoming Oregon's first and only national park.
Yeah, in 1885, William Steele, who became the founder of the Mazamas but also considered the father of Crater Lake, actually wrote to Peter Britt for the first time asking him for photographs to be used in advocating for the national park. I'm not sure which ones Britt may have sent to him, but it very well could have been his first from the early 1870s.
And then this other one is from a slightly different view, and there's like a little guy like with a walking stick or something. What's that guy doing? And we see some of the, I guess, is that called screed going down to the lake?
So this is the southern side of the lake, and you can see Phantom Ship here. He's also painted into it.
And the reflection of the mountains on the water. Yeah, that's pretty cool. And I was asking you earlier, these look kind of muted, and so I didn't know if our boy Peter was kind of gothy, but you said they're just dirty.
They're very dirty, but they've been around for a long time. And, you know, these are well over 100 years old, 150 years old, some of these, and they may never have been cleaned in their entire existence. So they hung in homes, they were exposed to a lot of dust, and, you know, they could have been in places where people smoke. If you had these clean, they would be spectacular.
And they're kept very lovingly protected here at the Historical Society. So most of that dirt and grime came before they were curated here with Anna.
That's right. Yes, but it's all part of how these paintings were part of people's everyday lives. So I think it adds an interesting dimension too.
Well, and Peter Britt, he was so well known in Southern Oregon, and because of his photography, but also apparently because of his painting too. And so other artists coming to the area would visit him. Mm-hmm. And so in 1882, he took a trip to Crater Lake with James Everett Stewart, one of the most important early Pacific Northwest painters. The time he came through, he climbed a lot. He climbed Mount Hood, he climbed Mount Shasta. Stewart came back from that trip. He painted some paintings for the Britt family, which are still in the collections, including the Mount Shasta, which I can barely see back
there.
We're gonna get there.
Okay, I'm pushing the art rack back into its position. Okay. Now I'm going to pull out the next one that has this wonderful Mount Shasta painting.
And we're getting the reveal in real time.
Oh my gosh, this is a classic James Everett Stewart. And so I'm going to be interested to look at the signature down at the bottom. He always dated his paintings. But probably from 1882, there is a photograph by Britt of him actually painting this in progress. It's sitting on an easel. It was probably done in the studio of the Britts when they came back from Crater Lake.
And it's got like real sunset kind of vibes. There's like some purple and blue hues. Okay, Peter is now crawling on the ground to look at that. Did you find the signature?
The signature and the date is 1882.
Wow.
Typically, also on the back of his paintings, he wrote more details. So we'll look at the back and see if he gives a more precise date. So this is a beautiful painting. I haven't seen all your paintings here, but this is going to be one of the most significant ones in your collection.
Wow.
And there are photographs of the Britt's home, like their parlor, and you can see this painting hanging in a place of honor. And they had a close relationship. There also is a little bit of correspondence. One letter that Stewart wrote to Britt in 1883, writing about, apparently Britt sent him some photographs of Mount Shasta and Crater Lake. And also after that trip, when Stewart went back to his studios in Portland, he painted several paintings of Crater Lake. They were a big sensation in the newspapers, but he was also telling Britt about how the critics of his paintings of Crater Lake said, you know, that blue is improbable. But, you know, if you're only going by photographs that are black and white and you've never been there, you have no idea of how spectacular the colors are.
And I know, too, that Peter Britt, some of his photographs are recognizable even if they're not signed. Because he was a portrait artist, his composition is pretty distinct. So that's one of the things that made him such a well-known photographer, and his son, Emil, never quite reached the same kind of reputation. And a lot of people have said that comes down to him learning that composition from being a portrait artist. Mm-hmm. And I know, Peter, you're always on the hunt for these kind of like iconic early landscape art pieces. So maybe you don't want to share your secrets with us, but what do you look for when you're like, oh, that's something really special versus just kind of the normal stuff you see at, thrift stores or yard sales?
Well, my collecting has evolved over time, and I'm always disappointed when things I've let slip through my fingers that I shouldn't have. And so, you know, there are just a few specific artists that I collect, and Mabel Russell from Ashland is another one. And I know there's going to be a Mabel Russell here, a beautiful one of Crater Lake, and her sister, Grace Russell Fountain. I collect them. And of course, their teacher, William Parrott, is my all-time favorite. But I have a few Stewarts as well. I really like Stewart. So there are a few people I just collect.
And so when you're looking at these early paintings and stuff, like, what's the so what of your project? Like, you want to see these early views? Are you looking at how people are forging this Western identity and this sense of place? Or what's kind of the thing that you're really hoping to get from these images?
Yeah, well, I'm especially looking right now at the role that landscape painters had in mountaineering in the 19th century. And Stewart was a mountaineer, and he was a member of the Mazamas. And William Parrott also climbed, and he was a member of the Oregon Alpine Society. But looking at the ways in which they pushed each other forward, mountaineering pushed landscape painting forward, and landscape painters, their role in mountaineering organizations.
They're the early influencers.
They really are. They're early influencers. And, you know, people would come to the Pacific Northwest having seen paintings of these magnificent mountains and would end up climbing them and then collecting the paintings, too.
And what about, like, that sense of, you know, they're creating this vast empty landscape, but they're also painting out people, indigenous people, and a lot of the violence of the West. So they're kind of creating this iconic imagery that's curated and false to some extent.
Well, for a long time, this European romantic convention of the sublime was painted into these images. And only, you know, when we get into the 20th century do Pacific Northwest painters start changing how they're painting and how they're interpreting. So even if indigenous people are included, they're often painted out of the canvases. But if they are included, they're usually highly romanticized. But that was the middle class market. It was a kind of an odd thing and contradictory. On the one hand, removal of indigenous people, eliminating their cultures and trying to make them into white people. And at the same time, painters, especially in the Northwest, were painting paintings, I don't see any of them here yet, where they're just highly romanticized images of indigenous people at the same time that they're being, you know, placed on reservations, or reservations are being ended and trying to force them into white culture.
And, you know, from the Historical Society perspective, Anna, like when you guys are figuring out what you give this very valuable space to, I see there's like another modern image next to that. So when we look at this as an assemblage, what do you see as the curator and how to caretake and identify what's going to be important to the region and future researchers?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, we don't get all that many new artworks into the collection, but...
Because Peter's buying them all?
Yeah, Peter. You know, at SOHS, we're really just interested in telling the stories of our region in all of the many ways that we can do that. So, you know, in the past, institutions like ours might have collected only paintings made by well-known artists or people who are sort of notable. But these days, perspective has changed quite a bit, and we want to be telling the stories of everyday people as well. So really, anything that tells a unique story about life in our region. Some of the more recent artwork acquisitions that we have are from a family of, they weren't missionaries, but they were really important in the Methodist Church in Ashland. It was a husband and wife duo, and we were able to get a painting by the husband and a painting by the wife, which is fantastic because, you know, I'm actually really interested in talking to Peter more about Mabel Russell and Grace Fountain, because female artists are underrepresented in collections like these and sort of across the board. We've got our one Mabel Russell fantastic landscape of Crater Lake, but women were often not recognized in their time as artists. It was often very difficult for them to sort of make their way. So we were excited to get this recent artwork in that is by a female artist, even in the 1930s, 1940s.
Okay, so now we're going to pull this one over, the big reveal.
Very nice. So this is a daytime. She also did similar ones, more like an evening, kind of a sunset view. This is a huge one. How tall would you say that is? At least
like
five feet?
It's like 5 feet by like 18 inches or something.
The University of Oregon also has a similar view. It's more square than rectangle, and it is has kind of a sunset cast to it that I think it's in the geology department. So
yeah, this is a real unique shape. It's really tall. What do you call that, hamburger or hot dog? Hamburger's the tall one and hot dog's the long one, right? Is that what they say with the portrait and landscape?
Yeah.
So Peter, what was the context in which artists like Grace Fountain and Mabel Russell were painting these things? Were they going out into the landscape and painting en plein air like others? Or?
Yeah, they would. Well, en plein air usually means doing finished works or in the outdoors, but they tended to be more impressionistic in the outdoors. But typically they would go and they would paint sketches and then bring those back to their studios. However, Mabel Russell spent a lot of time during the tourist season at Crater Lake painting for the tourists. So she probably was painting very quickly a lot of small ones and selling them there on the spot. There's this great story, it's September, sometime in the early 20th century. The temperatures dropped around Oregon and a huge snowstorm came through the Cascades and buried her and a sister, I'm not sure which sister, the newspaper didn't say which sister, in their tent, and they were there for like a week trapped.
Oh gosh.
So she spent a lot of time painting there, but this probably was done in her studio, I would say.
Well, thank you both so much for allowing me and the dear listeners to tag along here. I'm going to wrap up so you guys can nerd out in with the mics off. So you've been listening to Underground History on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Our show producers are Natalie Golay and Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and so much more wherever you get your podcasts.